Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was starting to investigate the animals who live inside her house. We resume Suburban Safari on page 226 with episode 22. On my first night of serious mouse trapping, I score. I shake the mice off the traps and onto a piece of aluminum foil. Crushed skulls aside, they're winsome. Their fur is gray-brown, with a browner shadow running the length of the spine. Their bellies are snowy. One looks young, its fur silken and flawless. The tiny feet shimmer with fine white fur. The whiskers are longer than the entire head, black near the nose, and then bleaching to white. The tail is as long as the mouse, gray-brown on top, white on bottom. The black eyes are large, the gray-pink ears as thin as the petal of a violet. Each animal is 2 inches long, plus tail. I try to identify their species. I can rule out Mus musculus, the house mouse who has followed Homo sapiens around the globe. He's all brown, top and bottom, and has a scaly tail. The other two species of house-loving mice look alike. The deer mouse and the white-footed mouse can be sorted only by a few details, and even those are unreliable. I read in an animal diversity database. I run through the details. The tail of the deer mouse is supposed to be cleanly divided between the gray top and the white underside. The white-footed's tail is more muddled. My mice have ruler straight tail lines. 1 point for deer mouse. The deer mouse may have hind feet shorter than 22 millimeters. The white-footed's foot may be longer than 22 millimeters. I take out my ruler. These feet measure 20 millimeters. Another point for deer mouse. Finally, the deer mouse is more richly colored brown, while the white-footed is more pinky buff. The color of my mice is difficult to describe. Milk chocolate truffle? I would say they're rich. These mice are as gorgeously pelted as any lion. A third point for deer mouse. One of the most amusing facts I stumble across in my mouse sleuthing concerns the deer mouse's ability to find his way home when dumped out of a live trap. Scientists have trapped and tagged mice and dropped them off far from home. They report that a mile is not far enough. A river is an insufficient barrier. A paradisal new habitat is not adequately attractive. Even relocating the same mouse twice or thrice won't discourage it. Scientists found that they could trap a mouse and dump him a half mile away for 3 days in a row, with the critter returning each following day. Equally curious is that an entire family of these animals will walk into mouse traps night after night. I place 2 traps a foot apart along the basement wall. Yet the vision of a dead relative in 1 trap didn't scare off the 2nd mouse. Not so amusing is the rodent's role in disease transmission. Both deer mice and white-footeds can carry hantavirus, which causes a dire respiratory syndrome. Their feces and pee can transmit the virus to me. But that's more a concern with the dust of dried waste, which can be inhaled. I'm not much worried. These mice on my desk are fresh and moist, and I'll wash well when I'm done with them. If my diagnosis is wrong and these are white-footed mice, then they're an important host for the deer tick, who transmits Lyme disease. But I bear the local mice no ill will on those grounds. We all carry plagues. When I'm finished with the mice, it's dark, and the crows have already flown across the harbor to their winter rookery. I fold the mice in foil, wrap them in a plastic bag, and pop them in the fridge. I spread more peanut butter on the traps and set them back in the cellar. In the morning, I toss the refrigerated carcasses out onto the snow for the crows. Their response is uncharacteristic. Normally, the crows approach my offerings on foot, with caution. Not this time. Two birds dive from the oak tree and barely touch down as they snap up the mice. They beeline to an eating tree. That night, I catch another mouse, and that is the end. This deep into the winter, mice have chosen their nests and arranged their food stores. My walls and ceilings should be quiet until next fall. The second ring of wildlife habitat my house offers is its exterior skin. I'm fortunate that it is seldom targeted for serious exploitation. Termites, for instance, find these latitudes too cold. Woodpeckers, who have taken to battering holes in my mother's wooden house, have limited their attention here to the trees, and in winter the suet bag. I do maintain constant vigilance against my squirrel friends, and the wasps, whose paper cones I initially welcomed on the chance that they were important pollinators, eventually came to represent an energy efficiency obstacle. In the fall, when a contractor came to discuss blowing insulation into my windy walls, he promised I'd get none of his cubed fiberglass until the wasps were gone. They put me through the ringer, those wasps, determined to avoid blasting toxic chemicals around my home. I nearly burned it down instead. The first colony I confronted was a baseball-sized nest on the porch ceiling. Recalling that beekeepers use smoke to pacify honeybees, I rolled up a newspaper and found a book of matches. Then, in case a few wasps came home after I applied the sedation, I put on gloves and a Gore-Tex jacket with the hood cinched around my face. I got a bread bag that I would slip over the slumbering village to pull it down. Out on the porch, I lit the paper and climbed onto a chair. The burning newspaper did release smoke up toward the hive. Yes, indeedy, smoke wafted right up into the little hole where the yellow and black heads were looking at me. But pieces of the burning newspaper also came off my torch. They drifted around the porch. I didn't pay strict attention to where they settled because the smoke was starting to have an effect on the wasps. If I had to describe the change in their attitude, I wouldn't say sedated so much as howlin' mad. When I jumped off my chair and ran for the door, I was surprised to see little fires all over the porch. I stomped out the flames, then banged inside. When I poked my head out a few minutes later, the hive looked quiet. I was done messing around. I opened my bread bag and hopped onto the chair, sleeved the bag around the hive, and yanked. It was too easy. A series of gray rings, like ripples in a pond, remained on the wooden ceiling. In my hand, the nest vibrated. This vibration aroused mixed feelings. Yes, I'd triumphed over my adversary, but these animals, who meant only to feed their baby sisters and produce a new queen, were going to die inside a plastic bag in my plastic garbage can. It was undignified. It was not a worthy end for these Amazon warriors, but I wasn't letting them out. I knotted the plastic. As I stood there feeling bad, a few wasps came home to the rings on the ceiling. By nightfall, a dozen had gathered, and they packed together for warmth. Sigh. That was the easy nest. Out back, another clan had found a dozen gaps in the caulking of the eaves, and these they used as tunnels to an interior nest. I climbed a ladder for a better look. The traffic didn't seem heavy, but when I pulled off the aluminum vent and peeked into the eave, I discovered a nest the size of an Anasazi Pueblo in the gloom. That was a lot of cellulose. Maybe all nests considered, I had more insulation than I thought. Nonetheless, I crammed bits of aluminum foil into the gaps in the caulking outside. I did yoga breathing and thought pure thoughts when the returning wasps hummed in for a landing on my fingers. My theory was that they wouldn't be able to chew through the foil and the colony inside would starve. The guilt caused my pulse to increase, but I concentrated on my breathing. I needed that cubed fiberglass. The overheating planet needed that fiberglass. It would be for the good of all wasps. My own wasps tapped and shoved at the foil. A dozen milled around, then two dozen. At three dozen, I backed down. Okay, that wasn't so bad. One to go. The tough nut was swelling to a football size at the peak of the roof. My first plan was to fully extend my ladder some dark night when the wasps were dreaming, then climb 25 feet to execute a plastic bag snatch. But my friends vetoed this, in favor of my not breaking my neck in the night. I could think of no way to get around the spray can of poison. The can, of course, warned against inhaling within 50 miles of its contents, or allowing the stuff to touch skin, or letting pets get near it, or allowing butterflies, bumblebees, little greenies, rove beetles, pearly pine bugs, ladybugs, ants, or Babette the spider to smell even the faintest concentrations on penalty of a writhing and painful death. It was apparently extra bad for fish, many of whom live in the ocean a few hundred yards downhill. I meditated to focus my mind. Fiberglass. Chemical salvation was a disappointment. For starters, the wide bungalow eaves kept the ladder at such a flat angle that midway up it became too bouncy to continue. I was fixing to poison the world and break my neck. I aimed carefully as the ladder shimmied. A foaming jet splattered on the paper hive. Some of it penetrated the nickel-sized hole. Much more bounced and showered down on my upturned face. My hands dampened in the rain. Droplets moistened the lawn and life below. A few wasp corpses, also wet, tumbled past me. But other wasps seemed immune. The next day they were busily tending the nest. I blasted them again, recoating myself. The label instructed me to bathe immediately. The wasps lived on. The third day I dosed myself a third time and gave up. I got a broomstick and wobbled close enough to swing at the nest. Naturally, it took about 15 whacks to dislodge it, but only a few warriors followed me when I clanked back down the ladder. On the walkway below, the fallen hive had split open. One larva, a large green gal, was humping away toward the grass. A dozen more larvae poked heads out of the paper honeycomb that was protected inside layers of wrapping. It was an astonishment, this paper city. I put the outer layers in a plastic bag and left it on the porch for a few days to off-gas, and I bathed. The hive paper was gorgeous stuff. The various plants that the wasps had chewed up had been regurgitated in stripes of silver, white, gray, muted green, and bronze. It was a winter dunescape. It was a watercolor of endless hills and streams on an overcast day. As homes go, it was stunning. I wish they had built it in a tree, but as a habitat choice, my house probably offered superior protection from the elements. I had the same thought when a pair of house finches set up housekeeping on the porch earlier in the year. Unlike a tree canopy, the porch roof is leak-proof. The first time I startled the female, I thought the hanging pot of fuchsia was an odd place for her to be insect hunting. After surprising her there a half dozen times, I had to see these irresistible insects for myself. Climbing onto the railing, I found a nest fitted among the fuchsia stems. An egg the color of a milky sky rested in the bottom. Mr. and Mrs. Bertelsmann, he wearing a handsome red hood, sat on the phone wire chirping until I left. I started greeting Mrs. Bertelsmann each time I came and went. She began to stay put, instead of flying off. When 5 eggs clustered in the cup, she settled in to incubate. The day I saw her return to the nest with food in her finchy beak, I knew she had succeeded. After she departed, I peeked. 4 purple, heaving birdlets with yellow beaks lay in the cup, along with a dud egg that would disappear in a few days. The babies, Bertelmans, grew. They propped themselves up. They squalled to beat the band. I recently read that when chicks coordinate their yelling, their parents work harder. As the kids swelled and fledged with rough feathers, their feeding became constant. And someone noticed, or maybe someone noticed me, when I hopped up on the railing to see them every day. Either way, the location of the nest was discovered. One afternoon, the parents sat chirping together on the phone wire. They hadn't had time for that in weeks. I climbed on the railing. One kid remained, dead. I blame a blue jay, who could have swallowed two whole and carried a third away. A crow would have battered leaves off the fuchsia, I think. I doubt a squirrel could carry three fledglings or chew them up at the scene without leaving blood. A cat might have jumped to the planter, but like the crow, would have done obvious damage. The Bertelsmans didn't make the same mistake twice. They re-nested somewhere in the backyard, continuing to visit the thistle seed feeder. And by late summer, they were escorting a handsome brood. Babette the spider and her front porch sister both had better luck with the human habitat. Each enjoyed waterproof shelter when foul weather struck, whereas a third sister inhabiting the flower garden spent rainy days under a leaf. This back-to-the-land sister blended well with her environment, but was nonetheless more vulnerable to birds than were Babette, who could retreat into the eave vent, and the porch sister, who often waited for her meals under the porch ceiling. When Babette first set up shop outside my window, I worried that wind eddies around the house might deprive her of insects, but she became the fattest of the three. The other folks who benefit from the outer skin of my house are usually short-term visitors. The seagulls normally patronize the tall chimneys on a house a block away. They changed their routine when I was working out the kinks of crow feeding. It took me a while to learn that any morsel larger than a nickel would attract the seagulls. So for a while the gulls moved to my roof, waiting silently for me to toss food into the yard. Now that I've settled on small dog kibbles for my crows, the seagulls have returned to their chimneys, which offer a better view of the neighborhood. The crows sometimes use my house for a perch, too, but it's rare. There was one day when all six picked pears from neighbor Hugh's tree and carried them to his roof to eat them. But I think that was a special occasion. I never saw them do it again. And although a crow once landed on the gable peak outside my office window, I'm not sure he was trying to get my attention. Spoiled crows have been known to tap on windows or fly in front of windshields if their caretakers forget to feed them. My crows have never been that forward. Even on these cold winter mornings, they don't call for food. They just sit on their begging branch and wait for me to notice them. It's the squirrels I keep the sharpest eye on. Crook and Fluff often travel from the lilac hedge to the deck roof to the house roof. It makes me nervous. Perhaps they see my roof as another element in their elevated trail system. But old sheet steel patches on my eaves testify to squirrels' eagerness to domesticate in attics. Who can blame them? I'm sure the leaf balls they construct in trees are marvels of engineering, but I wouldn't trade beds with a squirrel. So I don't turn a blind eye to their expeditions onto my roof. I make scary noises. I throw things. I try to act like a cranky neighbor. I get to wondering how far my house's sphere of influence extends. I know it extends farther than it ought to. The cap is insulated, but the walls are not. That I confirmed when I rewired the place and found the walls empty, vacant, airy. Given the age of the house, it isn't surprising, just horrifying. I was an impressionable teenager during the energy crisis of the 1970s. My parents insulated the attic of our ancient farmhouse, bought wood stoves, and yelped in pain whenever they found a light bulb blazing unwitnessed. Later on, the realization that energy produces pollution and changes the climate hit me hard. I developed my own allergic reaction to wasted watts. I became a bloodhound who bayed at the scent of cold air entering around windows. When I bought this old bungalow, I knew I was in for a weatherizing marathon. But I wanted to do it in a rational way, plugging the biggest holes first. Well, no. First I wanted to update the wiring and put in a kitchen. Then, once winter came, I called Wes Riley, energy auditor. It was horrible. Wes himself is not the least bit horrible. He has a little ponytail to compensate for some thinning elsewhere, and he makes jokes about his prior drug use necessitating a reliance on a camera rather than memory. It's what he shows me about my house that's horrible. Well, some of it is horrible. Other things he shows me save me thousands of dollars, but it will be a while before I forget the stench of the crawlspace dust that whistled through the living room when he fired up his portable wind. We'll start at the top and work our way down, Wes says, scooting through the crawlspace door in a bedroom. The entire upstairs is composed of slanted ceilings that meet knee walls. Behind the knee walls are enormous crawlspaces, vented to let the wind whisk through. Well, you've got 5 inches of insulation in the crawlspace floor, he says with some surprise, but you want to shoot for 12 to 16, and you want to eliminate these transitions. He means the slanted ceiling should continue right to the exterior wall of the house, rather than stopping at the knee wall. Heat departs at those transitions, he says. A house wants to mimic the shape of an animal in winter. Roundness minimizes surface area, and it's the surface that leaks heat. He emerges and turns his attention to the 80-year-old windows. I tremble. I know they're dismal. The frames are so rotten, I've gobbed them with silicone caulking to keep the glass from falling on the lawn before I can muster the clams to buy replacements. Wes doesn't look nearly as disgusted as I expect. He shakes his head. Replacement windows are the big lie, he says, rapping on the glass. What you've got here is R1. A brand new double-hung window would be R3. That's a very small increase. But here, he says, turning back to the crawl space, you could go to R19, and it's a much larger area. If you look at weatherizing in terms of how long it takes for an improvement to pay for itself with saved fuel, he says, replacement windows stink. They take 25 to 40 years to pay. Window quilts are similarly impractical. I'm stunned. He fingers my curtains, shears under a heavy drape. 2 layers of window coverings are pretty close to replacement windows, he says. I'm stunned and delirious. I've just saved $3,000 on new windows. The glass will fall out some day, and I'll have to do something, but for now, I'm off the hook. Wes finds the mold. It's in the cold corners of the bedroom, growing up the walls. Warm, moist air comes up from the downstairs, and it goes toward the windows, he says. Then it condenses on the cold spots. Then mold grows on the wall dew. Ew. Wes's point is that a house functions like a chimney. Heat rises up through it, seeking a way out. This draws in cold air through a million little leaks. If you accelerate the rising of heat by ignoring leaks upstairs or opening a window, then you speed the sucking in of cold air. On the ceiling, he finds just such leaks zigzagging across the plaster. All those cracks put together could make a significant hole right in the ceiling, he says, tracing them with his pen. The same with pipes and wire chases that go through your walls. Seal them, insulate the walls, close the envelope of the house. In the cellar, Wes saves me another $5,000. I'll be replacing the furnace, I squeak, rushing forward to block his view. It's an oil furnace converted to burn gas. The gas company confessed it's only 50-something percent efficient. The rest of my gas is wasted. I haven't even turned it on this winter because the gas-burning Jotul fireplace upstairs is more efficient. But again, Wes is not revolted. This furnace isn't that old. The conversion burner makes it very efficient, "Put your oil burner back on," he says, towing the Beckett burner on the floor. "Restore it to the way it was meant to run. It won't be the most efficient furnace, but with your insulated walls, you're going to use it less." I am again gleeful. My glee is short-lived. It's time to plug in Wes's wind. He replaces my front door with a red nylon panel. At the bottom is a large fan. A computer measures how much air the fan is pushing. By blowing air out of the house, Wes will simulate a 35-mile-per-hour gale hitting the outside walls. Then he'll calculate how quickly I've been sending my heat out into nature. He turns on the fan. It roars like a jet engine. He turns it higher and higher. He's having trouble depressurizing my house to the standard because air is leaking in so fast. That's bad news. It gets worse. We walk around now to find leaks. They find us. 100 storms howl through my house. It feels as though every window is open. Upstairs, the crawl space door I so carefully backed with fiberglass is leaking cleavers of cold air around every edge. Where the radiator pipe comes through the floor, a ring of wind rises, too. The outlets I rewired and carefully tucked under their fiberglass, they are spitting cold knives. The only good news is that my windows, their panes slimy with silicone and their rattling frames tamped with plastic wrap, are tight. The room is starting to smell like the dust of the crawl spaces. The fan roars on. At the top of the stairs, a light switch plate feels like an open freezer door. Downstairs, in the dining room, a gale whirls from each drawer in the built-in cabinet. The whole house smells like the crawl spaces now. Wes grins and opens the cellar door a crack. My hair blows back. "You think there might be some infiltration in the basement?" he asks. I'm sweating, though the indoor thermometer is at 58 and falling. This is torture. My house leaks like a sieve. It's a giant wood strainer. I'm burning priceless fossil fuels to heat the great outdoors. My sweat goes clammy in the wind. Wes is talking about the efficiency industry, but I can't concentrate. Heat is leaving my house even as he speaks, and I cannot bear it. I walk toward the fan so he'll shut the blasted thing off. He reads the fan's computer. My house is undergoing a full air exchange every hour. My goal is 3 hours. Horrible. But at least he turns the fan off. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is the Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaVar. Thank you for listening.